You know, it was a story that our dads and moms told us as we were growing up, and it was always scary and haunting and sad. And it made them sad to tell us, and it never had an ending. They would tell us that these people had died and the children were orphaned, and then the story would just end.
We didn't grow up knowing the story. I knew there was something very insidious that had occurred, but my mother never spoke about it. It just wasn't talked about.
Of all the documents that I've accumulated, Nola Romy's death certificate was the most shocking. His death certificate for May 17, 1929 says, lynched, slightly underlined, capital letter. It takes your breath away to see a document like that. Husna's death certificate says several gunshot wounds on May 17, 1929. So when you put those two documents together, what you believe is that there's more to tell in this story.
In 1967, I was going to stop to see Aunt Deanie in Birmingham, who was living alone. And late that evening, after having a real nice day in conversation and me asking her a lot of questions and her volunteering information she'd never told me before, she hands me this manuscript. It's about that thick, and it's all handwritten, tablets, loose leaf pieces of paper and so on. I said, what's this? And she said, that's 40 years of nightmares. And I said, what do you mean? And so she said, well, that's what happened to your grandparents. They were murdered.
Nola and Husna Rumi were among the tens of thousands of immigrants who traveled from Lebanon to the United States between 1880 and 1930. They each left their homes in the Pakal Valley between 1904 and 1906 and sailed for Ellis Island seeking work and prosperity in America. After brief stays in Brooklyn, New York, they traveled south along the railroad, joining family members in Valdosta, Georgia. As a young married couple, they operated a lunch counter and became a part of Valdosta's Lebanese community of 20 families who mostly operated restaurants and grocery stores. Life in America was divided along strict racial lines, and the country was experiencing a wave of strong anti-immigrant sentiment.
You are always going to come in as the other if you are an immigrant. But in a place like South Georgia and North Florida that is so bifurcated and so bipolar solely on the basis of black and white, the goal of immigrants is going to be, for the most part, to make themselves as white as possible.
When you look at the value that is added to one's personhood, when you can claim access to whiteness, it is kind of the basis of your access to economic improvement, to education, to social inclusion. You know, whether we're talking 1929 or 2019, it is a core idea.
Congress passed the Immigration Act of 1921. And the National Origins Act of 1924, restricting the number of immigrants from each country favoring Northern and Western Europeans. The Lebanese, like other Mediterraneans, were considered undesirable, and quotas restricted them to just 100 new arrivals per year. U.S. Senators Simmons and Reed referred to Lebanese immigrants as the spawn of the Phoenician curse and the trash of the Mediterranean.
In here somewhere will be Nola Romy. Did you find him? Yes, there he is. Nola G and Fanny Romy. Here's his wife, Fanny. They have a restaurant. And that is right. That's the address. 101 West Florida Avenue. And then this is their home at 319 Morgan Avenue. He was a successful merchant, as were a lot of the Lebanese people. They had grocery stores and restaurants, and we know there was a pool hall and a filling station.
Husna and Nola's hard work and attempt to start a new life in Valdosta quickly crashed into a rising wave of anti-immigrant sentiment, newly enacted restrictive citizenship laws, and violence. Beyond elite politicians and intellectuals, this racism, cloaked in the pseudoscience of eugenics, was given full and violent expression by the Ku Klux Klan.
The 1920s in particular are going to be the rehabilitation of the Ku Klux Klan, an entirely white fundamentalist Protestant organization which is going to have millions of members all over the country. It's going to get a new pseudo-respectability in the 1920s.
At certain points, you had governors, you had lieutenant governors, you had attorneys generals, you have judges who were open members of the KKK. You know, for us today, I think we have a very different understanding of the Klan. But understand, at that point in time, they were as American as apple pie.
It is going to inculcate this notion that to be a real American, you need to be a white Protestant.
There's also this fear of immigration, of Catholics who are coming over, of increasing numbers of Jews who are here. This anxiety around the future of America. And if we keep allowing these people who are not white Anglo-Saxon Protestants to come to our shores, that represents a threat to the core of this country.
The problem for a lot of immigrants is coming in that they just don't know those kinds of things. They expect to have people treat them as equal. I'm a business owner, you're a business owner, we should be able to talk. When they find out that's not necessarily true, it becomes a very steep and quick learning curve.
In 1907, Georgia outlawed the sale of liquor. As grocery store owners, Nola and a few other Lebanese immigrants capitalized on the new bootlegging market. In 1919, Nola was arrested for selling whiskey and sentenced to a year on the chain gang. As immigrants and Catholics, the Rumis experienced bigotry and suspicion. The starkest manifestation of this came on the evening of June 28, 1922, when five members of the Ku Klux Klan grabbed Nola from his store, threw him into the back of a car, and took him into the woods near the fairgrounds where they beat him severely. They told him to stop selling and drinking whiskey and never again to address a white woman. This was not an isolated incident. Other Lebanese immigrants had similar verbal and physical encounters with racially motivated violence. In an attempt to escape the persecution of the KKK, the Rumis moved further south to Lake City, Florida, believing things would be better.
Florida had the highest rate of lynching, if we look at it proportionally. And that's something that people really don't associate with the state. And different accounts have pinpointed Lake City as the lynching capital in Florida. While, yes, we need to understand that the majority of lynching victims were black men, anyone who was an outsider in this society was eligible for lynching. There were two Italians who were lynched in Tampa in 1910, and there was a white man who was a socialist organizer. His politics made him an outsider. We can come back to Georgia and talk about Leo Frank. His faith as a Jewish man made him an outsider. We can talk about the lynching of Mexicans out in the West. They were outsiders and threats to, you know, the expansion of white territorial aspirations. So at any point when we're looking at this, we would misunderstand lynching violence if we only understand it as something that African Americans were eligible for. Anyone who was outside of the realm of whiteness or on the fringes of whiteness was eligible for this type of treatment, as we see in the case of the Rumis.
In an attempt to fit in, Nola joined the Baptist Church and the Woodmen of the World, a philanthropic organization. But despite the family's efforts to become part of mainstream society, things got worse. Their daughter, Emmeline, documented the building storm in her diary. She wrote, "Mama and Papa said something one night about a Negro had been killed and a white man had been badly beaten but was still alive. All of this seemed to upset Papa and Mama and made them nervous." At school and around town, people would look at us with hatred in their eyes. Some of the boys would look at us and call us Dago, WAP, and a lot of ugly things. The Rumi's fears were realized on the night of May 16, 1929, when Nola was lynched and Husna was shot and killed by the local chief of police and deputy sheriff. The policemen, eager to exonerate themselves, claimed it began as an argument over fruits and vegetables displayed on the street and immigrants who would not obey the law.
So they had a grocery store there in Lake City, and the sheriff was always up their tail, pushing them to do this and do that, and tell them how to run their business, and don't put your so-and-so on the sidewalks, don't put your this on the sidewalk and all that. Well, other store owners did, but they didn't bother them.
It didn't happen to anybody else on the street that there was a problem with Chief Baker about the produce. It only happened with the Romies. Why they drove by the store, why this whole encounter started with the produce, it's a little bit hard to believe it was totally random. It's a really small town. Earlier in the week when their deaths occurred, the three little girls and Iser were in a car and they were driving around a lake in downtown Lake City, and they were hit by another car. And later the story evolves that this car was stolen, that there were two men in the car, that there was a weapon, that there was a large amount of money. And all of that story sort of disappears. But what matters to the Romy story is that Chief of Police Baker promised that the damage to the car would be repaid. The repairs to the car were made. Husna called Chief Baker and said, "You promised to make this damage right and to pay for the repairs." He said he had never made that promise, and she called him a liar. And if you're a police chief in small town 1929 Lake City, Florida, you're not going to be called a liar. That was just behavior they couldn't tolerate.
There are two different kinds of immigrant groups who are coming in the Gilded Age in the early 20th century. Those coming to big cities, northern urban industrial hubs, they're coming to just get some kind of work. They're working in horrible factory jobs. They're living in tenements. The people who are coming to these smaller southern towns are coming with a sense of expectation that they're going to be having more than just a job. They're coming here for opportunity, which means that they're used to dealing with people in a different way. They're used to being treated with a certain kind of respect that the White South isn't always going to give you. And naturally, in that situation, if you are used to being treated a certain way and now a policeman is treating you as if he deserves to be there and you do not, pushing back against that is dangerous, but understandable.
2 days before her death, Husna Rumi was arranging a display of produce on the sidewalk in front of her store when Chief of Police John Baker and another officer ordered her to remove it, claiming sidewalk displays were against town ordinances. Husna asked why they did not give the other store owners the same instructions. The police dragged Husna, who was 4 months pregnant, into the street and would have arrested her if a local doctor had not intervened, saying this was no way to treat a woman. When Nola returned from a supply run to Tampa, he was furious to learn how his wife had been treated. He called Chief Baker and challenged him to come to the store and discuss the matter man to man. Baker and three officers, Leo Cox, Bob Dennard, and Arthur Hall, arrived at the store shooting pistols in intimidation and beat Nola to the ground. Husna emerged from the back of the store with a gun and, believing her husband to be dead, shot Police Chief Baker in the arm. She was quickly gunned down by Baker and Deputy Leo Cox. Iser and Emmeline Rumi arrived on the scene as their mother lay on the floor in a pool of blood, and as officers took their father, unconscious and bleeding, to the city jail. Policemen beat Iser and took him to the separate county jail. Deputy Sheriff Leo Cox continued to beat Iser in the car and told him, "You are a goddamned nigger and you go to school with my kids. We've wanted to kill you for a long time."
Three men came to him in his jail cell and told him they were going to kill his father that night. I believe there was premeditation in separating the father and the son. I think there were plans early on that night and possibly before that night to take care of Nola Romy. He was a bit of a troublemaker. He had had previous run-ins with the law in Valdosta and possibly in Lake City. He didn't stand down to anybody, and neither did Husna. There were probably multiple reasons that a lynching might have been on their minds that night.
Later that night, May 17th, KKK members in white robes were spotted downtown in Lake City. The mob broke into the city jail, removed Nola from his cell, and lynched him. A farmer discovered his body early the next morning along the Fort White Road, mutilated by 13 bullets. Nola was a fourth victim of racial terror that year in Florida, and one of 10 people who were lynched by white mobs across the U.S. in 1929. Overnight, two Americans were killed, and four children orphaned because they would not accept the humiliation of being second-class citizens in America.
A lot of times when I talk about this story to different people, the question that many of them have asked at the very end is, well, then what happened? Wasn't anybody charged? What happened to the kids? And so other people too felt that they wanted the story to have a proper ending, and it just didn't. So little by little, I got more and more documents, and pretty soon I had a dining room table full of papers and notes and stickies and post-its, and it just got bigger and bigger and bigger. And then a rather darker side of the story emerged. There would be letter after letter in the lynching file that would say, you need to send a detective, send a plainclothesman, send somebody who can investigate this, because what you have now is the people involved in the murders are the people you're having investigate. It seems you are asking the guilty parties to investigate this matter. This is not the only dirty act that have been going on. The sheriff is reputed to be partner with another county officer in the ownership of what is known as Baker's Station. It is as wide open as any saloon, with a rooming house as low down as they make them. The sheriff's force also dole out confiscated liquor for gifts, and it is generally discussed by the public, but people are afraid to take any steps because it is as much as their lives are worth. With much regret that I can't afford to sign this matter, I will close. These people were afraid.
One of the near constant themes throughout the history of lynching is the involvement of law enforcement. You could not be elected sheriff in the South if you did not have a reputation for at least being willing to be brutal towards African Americans. That was your job.
The Lebanese outcry over the deaths of Nola and Husna led to a private investigation organized by the Al-Huda newspaper. But soon, at the advice of Lebanese attorneys, the case was dropped. The Rumi lynching had demonstrated that the whiteness of the Lebanese immigrant was in question. They believed that any further investigation could destabilize the Lebanese community standing in American society.
If you pursue an investigation to its end, more than likely, you're going to end up finding names that have helped to shape that community, that have helped make policy, and that maybe even are the law enforcement officials themselves.
If you invite animosity by drawing attention to yourself through protest, through something like a lawsuit or a legal case, you're not going to make a lot of friends. If the goal is ultimately to assimilate, to be able to claim whiteness, then organizing yourself in this way can be counterproductive. So I think that there's a bit of calculus that's taking place there, and the decision that's being made is that it's better to be quiet, to treat this as an anomaly, not to raise the ire, not to draw attention to ourselves, and just continue on this quiet path towards integration, assimilation, and enjoying the benefits of whiteness.
Nobody's bringing a lynch victim back. But the rest of us still have to live in a community that is dominated by white supremacy.
My grandparents were murdered by the KKK. It made me angry that that justice wasn't even a part of this equation. It's like everybody washed their hands of it. I know that my aunt, Aunt Denny, probably was more impacted than any of them. She lived 68 years. And from the time in her early teens, she's had that hole in her heart.
She lost everybody. And I think she continued to feel that loss till the end of her life. And she pretty much died alone. I was there the day before she died in the hospital.
She kind of like, just promised me you'll get this story told.
There are some family members who don't know the story, and then there are some family members who would rather the story not be discussed again. It's just too painful, too long ago. It is said that about 4 o'clock Friday morning, some parties took Romy from the jail, carried him about 2 miles on the Columbia Road, threw him into a ditch and shot him to death, 13 bullets going into his body.
Oh my God.
That's quite an article. The part of the story that I want also to remain is the heartfelt story of 4 children losing their parents. It's not a maudlin story. It's a story that just needs to be recounted as a child would have seen it that night. I beg to God to please let me see my mama's beautiful face without all the blood gushing out of her body. Mama, mama, I scream. Talk to me, mama. Please don't leave me, mama. I will be a good girl, mama. I love you so much, mama. I put my hands over her left breast to try and stop the blood from coming out of her body. Please, God, make it stop. Please let our mama live. Please, God, don't take our mama from us. Help her, God. Please let her live. We need our mama. I kiss her beautiful face. That's hard. If I could talk to her today, I would say, I hope we've told it right. And I hope we've told it honestly and with dignity. And I hope it would help you and your siblings remember your parents in a good way and not just their deaths. I would love to be able to tell her that.
Knowing your history doesn't mean celebrating your history. It means knowing it so that you can have the proper understanding of where everybody else is coming from. The reality is, immigrants who come here are Southerners. And we can never understand what the South truly is unless we understand those stories and broaden our picture of the South to include all of the people who get left out of those stories when people just like to wave a Confederate flag. If we don't know our true history, then we're not really Southerners. And all those people who claim that they are living that lost cause. And killing that is probably the most important thing historians can do.